G'day, leaders. In this podcast, we had the pleasure of speaking with Peter Aull. Peter is a multi-award-winning CIO. In fact, in 2017, he won the Australian CIO of the Year. And his career has a line of innovations that have changed the world around him quite dramatically. He's an amazing leader. I've had the privilege of observing him and working with his teams over the years. And in this podcast, we speak about how he thinks about innovation and what's important in leadership from his perspective. Enjoy.
Why did it count backwards? I know that we're now recording.
What? Hello, Captain. Come fly with me, let's fly away.
What are we going to talk about?
I don't know. So, leadership, life, and everything else.
Yeah.
And we're live.
No, we're recording.
There was a big echo there because we're in a different studio.
Yeah.
Today we have a special guest. And when we first put this podcast together, we made a list of people that we wanted to get on it. And Peter was at the top of our list and we finally made it happen. Welcome, Peter Aull.
Oh, thank you very much. Lovely to be here today in my own house.
So we came to you. And thank you for putting on this beautiful view out your window.
I know,
too.
Looking out the window.
It's pretty specky, isn't it? Yeah. Wouldn't want to be anywhere else right now.
No, it's beautiful.
Very good. Lovely to see you both.
Yeah, you too, mate. We met a long time ago, and in our leadership courses, I talk about you a lot. We talk about the leadership example that you've shown and I've learnt things from you. So thanks for taking the time so we can pick your brain about what makes a good leader.
Looking forward to it. Yeah. Pick away.
All right, let's start. So I'll throw you straight on the spot. I'll tell our listeners later why I believe you to be a great leader. But from your perspective, what makes somebody a great leader?
I think being authentic is probably the most important thing. So being who you are. So showing up in a consistent way, showing up, you know, believing in you. I think that's really important as a leader. A person told me once, the most important thing that you can do as a leader is be consistent. Mm. So if you're a crazy leader, be a crazy leader every day. Okay. You know, if you're an angry leader, be an angry leader every day. So, you know, if you're leading people want to know what they're getting. And yeah. I think that's a really important part of leadership. So that authentic and consistent approach to leadership is really, really important. Mm.
Now, when we were chatting just before, you mentioned Frankenstein leadership. What is Frankenstein leadership?
I think rather than taking attributes from one person, Michelle, in my life, I think what I've done is tried to glean things from people throughout my career. So, you know, people like Guy and people like others where you go, I like the way that they did that bit.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important thing to think through when you're creating your own style, not mimicking yourself on someone else, but actually building your own brand and your own style of leadership through taking bits and pieces. So Frankenstein's, I guess, my version of, you know, over my career, I've seen people do certain things. I said, I really like that.
Yeah.
I may not like everything that they do, though, and that's okay. Mm. You know, so it's about bringing those things in together and turning that into my own style, which I actually think it creates a point of difference rather than looking for a specific mentor. It's about making sure that you've got opportunities to look into the leadership styles of many.
Yeah. So what some of the body parts that you've taken?
the corks in the neck.
I was going to say, started with the bolts.
Look,
I think there's a few things. One is I've always, when I've been mentoring people, I got really good advice when I was in my late 20s. Someone said the first thing you need to do in your career is make a plan. And I'd never really thought about myself up until then. And went, okay, well, I need a plan, a leadership plan for myself as well as others. So I think even things like that, now when I mentor people, it's the first thing I talk to them about. Have you got a plan? Mm. You know, because I felt that was a really important thing that I never really thought through before. Mm. That was probably the only thing I took from that person. So, yeah. But, you know, I thought that was really clever advice to go, have you got a plan? You know, it was a real simple takeaway.
And was that, just on that, was that a plan for the next year, 5 years, your whole career? What was that?
Yeah, look, I sat down and built a plan, and I basically built a plan to say I wanted to be a chief information officer by the time I was 45.
Yeah.
And it was only because I had that plan I achieved that when I was 34.
Yeah.
All right, wow. Because, you know, it gave me purpose. So when I was looking at my next steps, I took backward steps sometimes. You know, it's from a monetary perspective, from a career, but some people were going, why are you doing that job now?
Yeah.
So it gave me that opportunity to think about the breadth of my leadership style, not just the depth. Okay, so it was about looking at ways that I could be full as a leader. If I wanted to be a CIO by the time I was 45, what were the attributes that I needed to actually do that? And I wasn't very strong in procurement and contract management, so I went and acted for the procurement and contract manager head.
Yeah.
I wanted to learn more about infrastructure management, so I went and, you know, did what I could to actually take over those sorts of roles. So when I was in my late 20s, early 30s, I was really starting to get that breadth rather than just depth. So that was one thing that I took away from that particular conversation. It formed part of my Frankenstein leadership style.
I like it. I want to hear more about the other body parts. I think you could coin this term and write a book. I think this is great.
I think I'd have to go actually copyright it after this podcast.
Yeah. Frankenstein.com. Frankensteinleadership.com.
There you go. I think, you know, I was around a leader that was really open with people about their performance, not judging people on time, but judging them on outcomes. And I saw that really early. And I saw the benefits of that really quickly as well, like sort of creating a culture where people weren't told to do things, they were encouraged to do things. So that was another element of leadership that I thought was really, really clever. Mm. And that balance between fun and accountability and structure, I think getting that right, particularly in my industry, is really critical as well. So that was another body part that I took from someone, to use your term, Guy.
I thought it was your term.
I think, you know, that balance is really important. And then on top of that, I had some really great leaders that were really strong with the rigor. So governance and looking at ways that we could make sure that we're investing correctly. So it was probably in my early 30s, I started to really hone in on effective decision making and how you make good decisions and what made good decisions, you know, and then what frameworks needed to be put in place were really important. I often found it interesting, having worked a lot of my career in governments, they've often got risk committees that manage risk. They don't have opportunity committees that manage risk. So if you come with a different lens, sometimes you actually open up a different door.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I think lots of people talk about innovation. It creates that purposeful innovation rather than innovation for the sake of it. So that governance part's are certainly another part of the Frankenstein leadership style.
Well, just going down that path of innovation, one of the things that you're quite famous for is the innovation trail that you've left behind you. We might talk about it now. You won CIO of the Year. That was, which year was that?
That was a while ago now, 2017. Yeah,
2017,
I think.
And that was based on the work that you're doing at that time at the City of Adelaide.
Yep.
And I had the fortune to watch what you did there. So could you just share with us some of the innovations that you did there? But more importantly, how did you arrive at them?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And this is, I guess, a really important part from my perspective around innovation. And innovation that's purposeful starts with really good discovery. So, you know, that sort of recognition was really, you know, a team effort around how we actually pulled together some of these innovative ways to deal with problems. So if you look at things like all of the projects that I've led, it starts with empathy, it starts with listening, it starts with, you know, at the City of Adelaide had a really clear agenda around Adelaide's growth. And I went, well, what can I do, you know, to participate in that? What are the things that I can build, or what are the things that I can contribute to actually help their growth agenda, which is really important for me to have that orientation point. So this wasn't just going off and doing something random. This, you know, homed back to the purpose of what the organisation was trying to achieve, and that was growth for the city. But, you know, again, that position of empathy. So these projects started with really strong discovery, going listening to people, going and talking to businesses, asking them questions like, why aren't you growing? You know, really important.
So was this like getting to understand exactly what the requirements were rather than the box ticking of, we think they need this?
Yeah.
Getting in there.
So if you look at Tangi Adelaide, which is probably, you know, one of the projects I'm most proud of, it's multi-generational infrastructure that's going to be, you know, accessed and leveraged over time. But it started with that question around, you know, really thinking through what is the problem we're trying to solve? And it started with people saying or thinking that they just needed faster internet services.
Right.
And that wasn't the case. All right. So it wasn't about faster internet wouldn't solve the problem. All right. This was about productivity at its heart, which was businesses trying to get access to the cloud. You know, and back then the cloud was quite new. And they were competing over the internet for services in the cloud. So they could see when kids get home from school, you know, start using Netflix or whatever it was, and there was congestion and contention on the internet. Excuse me. And when all they were trying to do was get to their cloud service. So if you look at that project, for example, Tengig Adelaide was more about how do we segment out networks, where internet becomes one service on top of the network. It's not the service.
Yes.
So part of it is business to cloud networks, part is business to business connectivity, part is the internet. So it's very different, but it started with that problem, you know. So there was a lot of pressure about, well, why can't just faster internet solve that problem? It may have, but it's not, I wouldn't have thought that's going to resolve the problem indefinitely either. So as we know, as soon as the internet becomes faster, guess what happens? We get 4K plus TVs and, you know, everything changes, you know, so that we can get higher definition.
If it was about growth in Adelaide, then more people coming to use it.
Correct.
Still,
yeah. So, and in fact, part of the story of that project was we were actually making the internet faster. So when you think about it, you know, a sub benefit of that project is you're taking traffic off the internet and putting it onto other parts of the network where it's not interfering with the network. So all of a sudden, kids get a dividend as well. So again, it's going through that process. Excuse me. It's going through that process of really that curiosity, you know, which is important, and looking at from breadth again, not just depth. You know, so sitting down, I'd often sit down, you know, at tables with people that were disadvantaged, or, you know, people that are coming from different personas, whether they're business owners or visitors or didn't speak the language, and ask questions. And I think that's something that we forget sometimes, particularly in my industry. You know, we're here to serve.
I'm going to tell a story, Michelle, about something that Peter did once, and then I've got a question at the end of it. So I was doing a presentation at one of the organisations that Peter worked at, and it was two rooms that had a divider. The divider was closed, but the computer that I was running my presentation on was in the other room, and therefore the little USB dongle for my clicker was in the other room. And it was pretty obvious early on that I had to run to one side of the room to click to the next slide, and then I'd run back to the middle, and then I'd click to the next slide. And I don't think most of the audience that were there, that was actually Peter's team, noticed what was going on after a couple of minutes. But after about 10 minutes, Peter just left the room, came back in, he'd walked into the other room, got an extension cord, plugged it into the computer, then walked up and then plugged my little dongle in, looked at me, put his thumb up as if to say, try it now. I tried it. And then no longer did I have to run over to the side of the room. And afterwards, I spoke to a few people that were in the audience, and they didn't notice any of that happening.
Wow, seamless transition.
So I'm presenting, and they're focusing on what I'm presenting. But Peter noticed a problem that was existing, straight away solved it. And then it was seamless for the audience. They didn't know what had happened. And afterwards, when I told them about it, they didn't even know that it had happened. And so I said, why didn't you notice that your new boss has walked out of the room, got a big USB extension cord, and fixed a problem that he saw in the moment? And then I spoke to Peter about it later, and he said, well, my job as a leader is to clear the way, clear the path, remove hurdles for people to be able to do their job. And where did that Frankenstein part come from?
That's a really good question. I think it's something I've tried to teach my children as well about what's next. All right, so when you're doing something, and I think it's, you know, my passion for building things and things like that, like, you know, my son now is fantastic with the what's next. All right, so, and what's next comes from understanding what's happening right now. All right, so if you're being present and observing, which you should, you know, if you're actually participating in something, you should actually be present, and you should be looking with empathy. So, you know, if I was building something and my son was with me, you know, he'd be thinking about what tool I need next, or if he was doing part of the role, I'll be looking at what he needs next. And I think that's an important part of that. Your question around where that came from, it's tricky to answer, and I think it's probably come from being brought up in the country where you don't have everything at your fingertips, so you've got to make do.
Yeah.
And I've never had an easy life. There's been no, you know, silver spoon in my mouth, for lack of a better word. You know, everything's been a hustle. You know, my mum passed away when I was 11. You know, I've had to put myself through everything. I've had to fund everything in my life myself, and I'm proud of that. But that comes with, I guess, an extra set of responsibilities. So you're far more resourceful. You're thinking ahead. You want to make every moment count, because if you're working during the day and studying what you can at night and, you know, trying to push yourself forward, you need to be resourceful. So, you know, looking at others is an important part of that.
So, yeah, I guess my question would be, though, you've been resourceful, had to be resourceful for yourself. When did that translate into you looking at the path in front of all of the people that you lead, which is what you do? I've seen this for years and years and years, and it's one of the things I talk about in our courses, is that you look at the path in front of all of those leaders who are leaders within your team, and you seem to look at the path forward and identify the obstacles, remove those obstacles, and quite often you're doing it without them even noticing that you're doing it. And that's something that we've spoken about before. That's your mindset. My job is to clear the path. So you've cleared the path for yourself, but when did it translate into clearing the path for everybody else?
I don't know the moments, but, and it's very humbling to even, you know, talk through these things. It's just how I am.
Yeah.
I don't think it's something innate about me. There's nothing, I don't think that's part of my Frankenstein leadership style. It's just part of me as a human being. Wow. Like I just think, you know, I care about people. I'm an empath, you know, I'm altruistic. I genuinely want to make a difference, and I want people to be, you know, making a difference, and I get my best kicks out of watching people succeed.
Do you know, one of the things I call you when you're not around, so we're both geeks. I started out in IT. You had your whole career in IT, but I call you a people geek as well as a technology geek. You're certainly a technology geek. Every time I speak to you, you've got the latest device, the latest this, latest that, but you're a people geek. I think you have a great perspective on watching people, learning about people and what they need from your leadership style, which is one of the things that I speak about.
Yeah, and I think it's about, like, that being presence important. And I think, you know, I'm not sure if I told you this story. I think I probably did, but, you know, I was at a restaurant on a weekend one weekend with my daughter, and I'm not sure if I've told you this story, but she was colouring in sheets, and the waitress, Emma, who was there, she had run out of colouring sheets, and my daughter Christina was quite young, and she was right into colouring, and she was getting quite frustrated at the table. So, you know, this is not just about me, it's about watching in others, all right? So, and I watched her walk away and come back with these extra colouring sheets, and I said, but you said there was none left. And she said, well, I just jumped on the internet and printed some more out. All right. And I went, wow, okay. And I said, what are you doing to her? And this was on a weekend. She goes, I'm studying IT, you know, in Sydney. I'm about to try and get a job. I'm worried because I live with my dad. You know, mum and dad had separated, I think. But anyway, dad was really important to her. And she was worried that she was going to have to leave, you know, the area to go get a job. And I said, no, you're not. You're going to come see me Monday morning, and here's my card. And she did. I said, you need to be there at 8:30, not 8:45, not 8:15, 8:30. So I put some conditions around that. She was there. I put her into the graduate program, and now I think she's in London doing, working as a HR systems engineer or something like that, earning a Monty and loving it. And we still keep in touch, but it's about not just identifying where are the challenges, it's identifying talent and people that share your vision, you know, and getting that tipping point. You're more likely to see me on a graduate recruitment panel than you are on a senior panel, because it's a lot harder to actually pick talent at that early stage from a cultural fit point of view. Because definitely in my industry, we teach people a lot of things. You don't have to have all the things there at the beginning.
I do remember you telling me that story, and I think what a great example of identifying in somebody skills that aren't necessarily the technical skills that we look for in particular jobs and industries. Where, you know, does your CV, or do you have a
degree? Just customer service.
Yeah, and it's thinking,
empathy
skills, empathy.
I mentor people and generally young people, and one of the things they say is that they're worried because they are so young, so inexperienced. They haven't, they feel that they're in competition with people who are already in the industry. And I tell them that they have an amazing opportunity because people tend to have a bias against every generation and, you know, different cultures, etc. So if you do anything that is outside of that bias, outside of the stereotyping of that bias, then you stand out as being, wow, you're amazing. So I encourage these people to, these young people to reach out. You know, people say, oh, young people don't want to communicate. You can't get them on the phone. They only want to text. They use emojis to communicate. If so, I've heard from some of the young girls, they'll send a letter or they'll contact on LinkedIn somebody that they admire, they want to work with, work for, or want to speak with. And these people are so taken back by the fact that they reached out. They're like, wow, you must be amazing. And so they're using the stereotyping and the bias to, and these people are very, like the young girls that I talk to are very intelligent anyway. They just are not sure because of their self-confidence hasn't grown yet. So, you know, it's utilizing that, that ingenuity that you would use at home in the, you know, in their other jobs as part of their toolkit to actually shine and show their point of difference.
100%. Just to pick up on one interesting fun fact that I'm not sure you probably have thought through this, but isn't it ironic that back in Egyptian times we wrote in hieroglyphics and now we write in English and now we're back into hieroglyphics again. So it's just picking up on your emoji sort of point there. It's I find that sometimes hard to actually translate, but and I wonder if, like, in another, you know, 10,000 years time, people will look back and go, what were they talking about back then? Yeah. What was this thing with the mushroom coming out of its head? Was there a nuclear war or what was going on? They have some, you know, special sort of research facility that just, you know, unpacks emoji conversations. You're right. And I think just to your point, Michelle, around confidence, and I think part of leadership is actually helping people build that, you know, giving them permission. Part of leadership is to create safe space where people can actually experiment. Not forever. It's not about failing forever, but if you're going to fail, fail fast. And as a leader, you're there to actually guide the way. You're not there to tell the way. And I think that's a really critical thing to do. And I think building people's confidence, in my experience as a leader, comes in multiple facets. It comes in creating that energy in the team, that culture that's not just about, you know, people often talk about how do we create an innovative culture. It's not. It's just about creating a culture where people feel okay being themselves. So back to the original point of leadership, it's about being authentic. Everyone feels different at work than they do at home often, you know, so how do you create a space where people can just be themselves? And also, as a leader, you need to find where the square pegs are in the wrong hole. You know, everyone's got their area of passion. If you can find that, you know, it's a home run for them, for you, for the organisation, for productivity. So,
well, they've got skin in the game then.
They've got skin in the game. And they go home. I have this belief, you know, call me crazy, but I have this belief that most people want to go home at night and go, I smashed it out of the park. Right? They want to go home at night and go, I absolutely smashed it. They don't want to go home at night and go, not sure how it went today. You know, so, you know, if you create that environment where they feel successful, you know, that breeds success, I think.
Can we go back to the innovation piece? Because your career is littered with, that's probably not the right term. There is a plethora of innovations that you've left behind when you've moved on to the onto your next role. The innovations that are just strewn, is that the right term? Strewn behind you.
Strewn.
But one of the exercises we do in a critical thinking course is I get people to break up into groups and we give them a very famous thinking problem by a guy called Edward de Bono. And then they come up with a solution and I get everyone to share their solution. They throw it in the middle of the room. And 9 times out of 10, actually more like 99% of the time, as soon as I throw their solution into the middle of the room and I ask all the other groups to discuss it, they tell them why it won't work. And my big message to the world is that every company wants to be innovative, Did I say that right? Innovative. And it's a value on everyone's wall. But I think what stops innovation is leadership behavior. Because when I come to you with an idea, and if your first instinct is to tell me why it won't work, I'm not coming to you with an idea again. So with a career that's full of innovations, how do you go about creating an environment in your teams where innovation can thrive?
And I think innovation's a really overused term as well. Like, I've often seen innovation that's not purposeful also.
Yep.
All right. So I think, whilst there has been innovative things that have happened through my life, I think it's more the purposeful part of it that I'm proud of, not necessarily the innovation at the back of it. So I think back to that process of empathy is really important. So I've never ever, been upset with anyone if they've come to me and said, I've made a mistake. And when we've unpacked it, they've said, here's the process that I went through to make a mistake. And I think that's really important. You know, it's important for people to know that it's not just about doing things that are in their, in their thought bubble. It's about going through a process so that we can make sure that, when you're investing things, you're actually doing it with purpose. Mm. And that's really important. I've got a saying as well, and it's hard to create, it's easy to criticize. So at your point about your activity that you do when you're doing coaching, throwing something into the middle of the room and everyone's saying how it's not going to work. Innovation for me, and I've been around leaders that have believed in me, all right, and that's important also. Having someone that is your champion that sits above you, and that's your role as a leader, that be that champion for people underneath you. So it's almost paying it forward. Not closing the door before, at the early stages is really, really important. So, I've often had people, be critical of things, after it's been created because you can. And that's healthy and that's okay. But it's far harder to create something for the first time. And that's what innovation should be. It's not copying someone.
Yeah.
All right. It's doing something different. So allowing that space for people to have that ability to be curious.
Have you ever had an experience where, especially in early, when you started out your journey, where you've had ideas and you can see, because you're a brilliant person, but you can see how it's got legs, how this will work, but those around you haven't at the time. How have you managed to, one, go on, but two, remove it from yourself, your ego? And we talk about this in one of the courses about ego and confidence and being able to remove an idea so they're poo-pooing the idea, not you.
Mm.
How have you managed to do that, or have you ever had to do that?
Yeah, look, and I think, when I was in my 20s, when I was honing my skills in these areas, I failed dismally a number of times. I took it personally. I tried to own it, and that wasn't, that's not a good way of looking at things. So I think I'm going to harp on about this, but it's the process.
Mm.
If you go through a good process of curiosity and empathy and understanding what it feels like, not just looks like, but feels like from someone else, it's very hard to debate. Because anytime things get wobbly, you home back to what's important. Mm. So at Adelaide, it was the Claire story activity that we did.
Yep.
People would say, how would Claire feel? So you actually need to go through a process of passing the baton back to the owners, who are the consumers of whatever you're trying to achieve. So.
Yep.
I think that's, from my perspective, that's the answer. It's the process. So you're actually resolving a problem.
Mm.
And two, it is allowing people to be participating in that by going through a process of understanding. So it's the why. If you're a Simon Sinek fan, it's the why, not the what and the how, that really matters.
Yeah.
And then allowing them to actually take courage of that. And then you're there to guide.
Mm.
It is hard, because, good leaders, innovative people, purposeful innovation, can see over the horizon. It's not just about what's in front of you.
Mm.
Some people can't see over the horizon. So it's challenging sometimes to actually take people along for the journey. So, what I've learned is it's that process, that human-centered approach to things, that customer-focused approach to things, allows people to see what it would feel like, what the future would feel like, not just look like.
So you need to be a good salesperson as well.
I think you need to be a good storyteller.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think you need to be, and not telling fables.
Yeah.
all right, you need to be a good strategic storyteller about finding out, again, what is it the organization, what is it, if it's an organization or if it's a home, what's your purpose? You know, what's your North Star? Like I said, at Adelaide, it was growth. You know, it's really interesting when I was working in Department of Planning, Transport and Infrastructure, it was getting people onto public transport. Now, what is it? So if you can hone in on that, the rest of it becomes a little bit simpler, I think. Mm. All right. So it's not about me anymore. It's not about you anymore. It's about, here's our goal. You know, are we all attached to the goal? Yep. Okay, let's go.
Mm. Mm. I remember you told me a story when you were at Planning, Transport and Infrastructure that you put things into the bus to measure the frequency of brake touches or something along those lines to then measure the level of the customer's experience in a bus that's either not having the brake applied a lot. You know those drivers that tend to touch the brake. Yeah, I found that fascinating that you're looking at data that is just simply, it was a way of thinking that I wouldn't have come up with.
But that was the process, guy. So if you're looking at patronage, like getting people on buses, what are the influencing factors of patronage?
Yeah, if they're experiencing a bad ride, they're not going to continue to do
no.
it.
So we broke that down. It was quality, accessibility, all these different, and then we did sub elements, and then we looked at the data sets around that.
So if you focused on that,
people can't see my hands moving here. Focus on that, and you're going to shift the dial.
So when's this book coming out, Pete? I think you've got a lot to offer with regards to your processes and your thinking effect. Style. The Frankenstein leadership. There's a few books here.
That's right,
I might just throw one last question at you, Peter. What are you most excited about in the future?
I'm most excited about being back in a leadership role. I'm really excited to be back being a leader again. I think it's something that I've desperately missed and I love. And I judge myself on the splatterings of people, that I've been, able to lead over my career that have been successful. And I think that's, putting all, the innovations aside, that's the thing that actually gets me up in the morning. I really love working with people genuinely. I love seeing them succeed. I love watching them grow. My best stories are people like Emma, people like that, that I've had the pleasure of participating. When I get a LinkedIn message from someone saying, I've been looking at servant leadership styles and it's you, Peter, that, it sort of triggered that thought. So yeah, I can't wait to get back into the saddle and, hopefully help some people in not just the organisation, but in themselves as well.
Well, Peter, if I can leave you with this, I've known you for quite some time. I've watched you throughout your career. We met a long time ago, and I don't not only consider you a friend, but I consider you a leader worth emulating. I've learned a lot from you, but I've also had the fortune of speaking to a lot of the people that you've led over the years, and the way they speak about you behind your back just is a testament to the style of leadership that you have. So thank you for today. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. We could have spoken for 5 hours based on the amount of knowledge that I know you have. Maybe we can do podcast number two at some stage in the future.
I'll be happy to. There's a lot more in this. And there's a deeper dive for sure. I'd be really interested to actually, for myself, being questioned like this is good because it allows me to think. So it's good. So thank you.
So we really appreciate it.
Michelle. Thanks, Guy.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Pete.
Cheers, mate.
Well, that was fun.
That was fun.
You're such a clown.
The clown.
Lady Captain. Lady Captain.
And who's going to listen to this? Maybe our mums.
Thanks, Mum.